1, found solace in the fact that Germany had defeated Russia in World War I, and with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk had stripped the infant Soviet government of 1 million square miles and 55 million of its people. In Hitler's view, Stalin's communism would probably not marshal sufficient Russian manpower and willpower, given that at the outset of the Soviet state, Lenin had surrendered these large swaths of Russia to Germany and Turkey in March 1918. After the victory in Poland, Hitler, not his generals, had rightly insisted that the army could next wage a successful peremptory war in the West when his cautious OKW worried about supply shortages and operational deficiencies. On every occasion, Hitler, not his commanders, proved prescient, at least in the short term. In addition, the Soviets had not fought particularly impressively in the divvying up of Poland in September 1939, or the Finnish War of 1939 and 1940. Little was known in Germany about Marshal Zhukov's decisive victories over the Japanese along the Mongolian border in the battles of Khalkhin Gol, at least in comparison with Hitler's greater knowledge of the Russian disasters of 1904, 1905, and 1918, and Stalin's mass purges of the Soviet military between 1937 and 1939 that had led to the deaths or imprisonment of half of all the officers of the Red Army. In short, overconfidence also allowed Operation Barbarossa to proceed without focusing on clear objectives. There was a litany of unwise tactical decisions that might have been averted, well beyond the sudden redeployment of Army Group Center from its original Moscow route in August 1941 to join Army Group South in its encirclements of Kiev, and the lack of logistical preparation for operations beyond 6 months. Hitler ordered a siege rather than a direct assault on Leningrad, when it might have been possible earlier to have taken the city. He relieved, either directly or through his senior commanders, at one time or another, the Wehrmacht's most successful officers, von Bock, Guderian, von Lieb, von Rundstedt, Manstein, as well as 35 corps and division commanders alone in December 1941, often for arguing over necessary tactical pauses or withdrawals. Had the Russian winter that typically favored the defender over the attacker been more typical, a month later in onset and of less severity, or had Hitler not gone into the Balkans in April 1941 to put down an uprising in Yugoslavia and to salvage Mussolini's Greek misadventure? Or had Hitler not declared war on the United States on December 11th? Or had Hitler not again divided the forces of Army Group South in summer 1942 during the drive to the Caucasus, Case Blue? Then there would have been an outside chance of at least short-term success. All those what-ifs cloud the reality that Germans were also a northern people who should have known as much about winter conditions as the Soviets. In the 1933 training manual of the German Army, officers were advised that ears, cheeks, hands, and chins must be protected during cold weather. Besides additional warnings about proper clothing and supplies, the manual emphasized that winter equipment requirements for men and horses must be planned well in advance. Nor was the Soviet Union an exotic Ethiopia or even a distant United States. Instead, it was a known commodity, a nation that had been more or less allied with Hitler since August 1939, and one that had enjoyed military cooperation dating back to the early 1930s. The idea that Hitler may have had no clue about the existence of the T-34 tanks is ipso facto an indictment of the entire mad idea of invading the Soviet Union without adequate intelligence. And the problem with Operation Barbarossa was not so much diversions and redirections of German armies, but the lack of sufficient manpower and equipment for such a vast enterprise in the first place. Hitler's December 11, 1941 declaration of war on the United States soon proved cataclysmic to German fortunes of the Eastern Front. The serious American strategic bombing that commenced in late 1942, along with Britain's ongoing effort, would eventually divert well over half the Luftwaffe's fighters from ground support in Russia to high-altitude bomber interceptors over Europe. Worse still for German ground troops, by 1943 German aircraft production had flipped, for the first time producing more fighters for the home front than ground support bombers for the Wehrmacht on the Eastern Front. At least 15,000 superb field guns of various calibers likewise would be kept home outside German cities as flak defenses against Allied sorties, robbing the army of too many of its most effective weapons against Soviet tanks. 10% of the entire German war effort was devoted to producing anti-aircraft batteries and ammunition, and well over 80% of all such guns were deployed inside the Third Reich against British and American bombing attacks. One of the many reasons why the Luftwaffe could not supply the trapped Sixth Army at Stalingrad, aside from the weather, fuel shortages, and anti-aircraft batteries, was the inability to make up for the prior losses of transport planes during the invasion of Crete, and the later costly efforts at resupplying the Africa Corps in Libya. For all Stalin's snarling attacks from 1941 to June 1944 on the British and Americans for failing to open a second front, the sudden rapidity with which the Red Army went on the offensive in 1943 was in part due to transfers of German resources from Russia back to the Mediterranean and the German homeland. An instructive way of understanding the historical role of Operation Barbarossa in determining the outcome of World War II is to consult General William Tecumseh Sherman. Even after the capture of Atlanta, he had forecast that the American Civil War would not end until the South's elite fighters were killed. "I fear the world will jump to the wrong conclusion, that because I am in Atlanta, the work is done. Far from it. We must kill those 300,000 I have told you of so often." What Sherman saw had to be done to the Confederate Army was done to the Wehrmacht by the Red Army at the cost of well over 8 million of its own soldiers between mid-1941 and early 1945. It neutralized what, by all consensus, was the best fighting force in the history of land warfare, albeit often unwisely and with unnecessary costs. At times, the Soviet Army committed nearly as many horrific atrocities as the Germans, and savagely raped and pillaged its way through Prussia. It reneged on almost all its assurances to the British and Americans made at the Yalta Conference, February 4th through the 11th, 1945, to allow liberated nations of Eastern Europe to form their own autonomous governments by free elections, once it crossed into Eastern Europe. But more than any other force, it destroyed the infantrymen and armor of the Wehrmacht. The Russian front not only fatally weakened the German army, but also revived the moribund Western theater. England had survived the Battle of Britain, and when Hitler's attention turned eastward, it took advantage of such a reprieve to reformulate its army, to send armies abroad, and with mixed success to attack the Axis powers where they were weakest. With the U.S. entry into the war after Pearl Harbor, the Anglo-Americans would eventually return to France in June 1944 to fight in a way utterly different from the manner in which the French and British had fought 4 years earlier, ending at Dunkirk. Just as there had been two phases of Soviet retreat and advance on the Eastern Front, so too World War II would see two continental wars for Western Europe, the first ending badly in June 1940, and the second beginning well in June 1944. In the next chapter, how the wars on the ground turned global after 1941 is described through a variety of reasons. The Soviets in 1943 did not collapse, but retreated and regrouped in a way the Western Europeans had not in 1940. The Red Army went back on the offensive against Germany without the need of a substantial navy or vast air fleet, in a way that the armies of the Anglo-Americans, eventually to be based in Britain, could not. A common theme developed in the various theaters in China, Burma, and the Pacific Islands, along with the fighting in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. The newfound alliance of Britain and the United States as yet lacked armies large and experienced enough to invade either the German or Japanese homeland. That fact drew their ground forces to the circumference of the Third Reich in North Africa, Sicily and Italy, and the Pacific Islands and Burma at the edges of the Japanese Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. By late 1943, the ascendant British and American armies had evolved into experienced, deadly forces and saw their expeditionary fighting in the Mediterranean and Pacific as the necessary requisites for invading Germany and Japan in order to win the war decisively and to win it on their terms. 13. Armies abroad. As the Russians slogged it out from mid-1941 to 1944, their British and American allies avoided direct pathways to Germany and Japan. Yet by fighting in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy, while their own homelands were largely untouched, the Anglo-American armies grew experienced, lethal, and well-supplied. In the Pacific, the Red Army had ceased fighting the Japanese in 1939 and honored its non-aggression agreement of April 1941, putting the onus on an eventual Allied attack on Japan seemingly on the shoulders of the British and Americans. Unlike Germany, Japan was an island power with a formidable navy, making any landings on the Japanese home islands even more challenging than invading occupied France. Therefore, the British and Americans first sought to peel off rings of the Japanese land and maritime empire, mostly by using their amphibious ground forces to cut off supply lines to the homeland and to secure naval and air bases critical to support the eventual ground invasion of Japan itself. The weather of the Mediterranean was warm and clear and conducive to both air and armored operations. In contrast to the later Russian front, German generals felt that Africa was paradise, nor did terrain pose serious impediments. Unlike 1917 and 1918, when the British had sought to destroy the Ottoman colonial empire in the Middle East, Arab resident populations of North Africa were not much of a factor, without strong inclinations to support either side. Both sides fought on neutral ground. Perceived victory or defeat hinged on their own actions rather than on external factors beyond their control. At least until the arrival of the Americans in November 1942, the ground war was fought mostly by expeditionary forces, British, French, German, and Italian, familiar with the North African littoral landscape. The theater fighting is often dubbed desert warfare, and it was, for the most part, but in a desert corridor that was, in many places, populated and in sight of the Mediterranean. Nor was there the savagery that characterized the Eastern Front and later at times the Western, largely because the war was not over the home soil of any of the belligerents, and the Soviets were not involved. The Americans had not fought against any European army in nearly a quarter century. Both the British and the Italians had only campaigned a few weeks in France before meeting up in Egypt. The French would eventually fight on both sides. In sum, North Africa was the first meeting of all the major European Axis and Allied armies and proved the arena for a sorting out process in which the supposed inexperienced forces evolved and the apparent veterans stagnated. Because it was the first great front involving most of the armies of the English-speaking world, North Africa is oddly better known than the far more important cauldron on the Eastern Front. After the declaration of war on the British by the Italians on June 10, 1940, the two were initially the only major belligerents with forces in North Africa. At that moment, the Axis seemed to have the most potential for controlling the African coast. The French navy was soon neutralized. The creation of Vichy France turned Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia into veritable Axis ground. The Regia Marina enjoyed numerical parity with the Royal Navy on the Mediterranean. It posed a real challenge to British supremacy, given the latter's responsibilities to protect convoys in the North Atlantic. The few British troops in North Africa were far to the east in Egypt, protecting the Suez Canal and the port at Alexandria. The North African War initially hinged on whether small pre-war constabulary British forces could survive and keep entries into the Mediterranean at Gibraltar and the Suez Canal open. Had Britain lost Suez, Malta, and Gibraltar in 1940, there never would have been an Allied landing in North Africa in November 1942, and the Mediterranean may well have become Mussolini's Mare Nostrum, spelling an end to a key British lifeline. On the other hand, maintaining troops abroad while Britain was being bombed at home was Churchill's risky proposition. General Alan Brooke, chief of the Imperial General Staff, had noted as late as summer 1941 of Britain's scarce resources, vast commitments, and endless debates concerning where to defend and where to withdraw. These are all questions where a wrong answer may mean the end of life as we have known it in this country and the end of the British Empire. With Western North Africa under collaborationist France, the Italian 5th and 10th Armies, accompanied by auxiliary forces numbering nearly 250,000 troops in 14 divisions, combined to head eastward from Libya against General Archibald Wavell's Middle Eastern command of some 40,000 British Imperial troops in Egypt. Wavell was a sober and steady commander, but he faced an unenviable situation without much chance of immediate reinforcements. A 250,000 Italian occupation troops to the south in Italian East Africa were static but still unconquered. Another enemy army of roughly the same size was advancing from the west, with the likelihood that some German reinforcements would show up at any time. After a brief war and victory against the British the prior month in Somaliland, the Italians had convinced themselves that because of their numbers, they would likely bury the British in Egypt and annex North Africa into the Italian Empire. The huge size of the Italian army fooled few. It had no updated armored vehicles comparable to even the British lighter cruiser tanks. Its sole competent and charismatic commander, Air Marshal Italo Balbo, who served as commander-in-chief of Italian North Africa, was shot down by friendly fire over Tobruk on June 28, 1940. His loss resulted in centralizing the supreme command under the well-connected Marshal Rodolfo Graziani. But the hesitant and mediocre Graziani dallied for weeks until mid-September before invading Egypt. Without the machines or the supplies to match a British force a fraction the size of his own army, Graziani privately predicted disaster. He soon got what he prophesied. Count Galeazzo Ciano, Italian foreign minister and son-in-law of Mussolini, glumly wrote in his diary of the Italian misadventure, "In Libya, an Italian general has allowed himself to be taken prisoner. Mussolini is taking it out on the Italian people. It is the material that I lack. Even Michelangelo needed marble to make statues. If he had had only clay, he would have been nothing more than a potter. A people who for 16 centuries have been an anvil cannot become a hammer within a few years." 8 days after that entry, on June 29th, Ciano commented on General Balbo's death. "A tragic mistake has brought about his end. Balbo did not deserve to end up like this. He did not desire war and opposed it to the last, but once it had been decided, he spoke with me in the language of a faithful soldier, and if fate had not been against him, he was preparing to act with decision and daring." By August, Ciano was adding even more pessimistic entries. "The water supply insufficient. We move toward a defeat which, in the desert, must inevitably become a rapid and total disaster. I reported this to the Duce, who was very unhappy about it because in his last conversation with Graziani he had understood that the offensive would start in a few days. Graziani did not set a date with me. He would rather not attack at all, or at any rate, not for 2 or 3 months. Mussolini concluded that one should not give jobs to people who aren't looking for at least one promotion. Graziani has too many to lose." Italian air forces in North Africa, some 300 bombers and fighters, on paper seemed impressive. In fact, fuel and parts shortages grounded much of the Regia Aeronautica. Meanwhile, the fuel-short Regia Marina was too worried about encountering the Royal Navy near the Egyptian coast to ferry supplies along the Italian route of advance. Outnumbered British forces were commanded well enough by Generals Wavell and Richard O'Connor. The British retreated as the huge Italian 10th Army marched over 60 miles into Egypt in an amazingly short 3 days. But inexplicably, Graziani then hunkered down at Sidi Barani, waiting for further supplies from Tobruk to blunt the inevitable British counterattack. Rarely in military history had an advancing expeditionary army simply stopped in its own tracks of its own volition. Still, it took the mostly unprepared British almost 3 months to resupply and go on the offensive, Operation Compass. But in another 3 months, they drove the Italians back into central Libya, effectively destroying the Italian 10th Army, taking somewhere between 110,000 and 140,000 prisoners, along with the army's entire supplies of mechanized vehicles, guns, and planes. The British then went on to chase the poorly supplied Italians beyond the port at Tobruk, which was to change hands 4 times within 18 months. The key Libyan port fell to the British on January 22, 1941. Of the Italian defeat at Bardia, January 5th, Anthony Eden was later supposed to have said, "Never has so much been surrendered by so many to so few." With air and naval superiority and resupply through Tobruk, the giddy British pressed on to Benghazi and should have closed out the theater for good in victory. They arrived there in early February 1941 and then advanced further along the coast to El Algeila, well over 600 miles beyond the original British launching point in Egypt. There were only some 100,000 Italian troops left in Libya, and the British needed only to stop the resupply at Tripoli of the surviving Libyan Fifth Army. When combined with the successful evacuation from Dunkirk in June 1940, the inability of the German army to invade Britain, the ongoing resistance against the Luftwaffe during the Blitz, and the pushback against the U-boat campaign, the destruction of more than half of Italian forces in Italy, reminded the world of the courage of the outnumbered and often overstretched British military. But Churchill, with perhaps more pressure from generals like Wavell and others than he later would admit, reluctantly ordered the pursuit stopped at El Algila, Libya, in order to transfer precious British veteran forces to the lost cause in Greece, Operation Luster, on the admirable but unsound principle that Britain's only active ally, Greece, should not be abandoned. Nearly 60,000 troops would be sent from Alexandria to Piraeus, the Greek port of Athens, in a doomed effort to stop the Wehrmacht's Hellenic invasion, which would reach Crete by April. Over 20,000 British soldiers would be killed, captured, or wounded, a needless sacrifice that failed to stop the fall of the Balkans, but ensured for a while longer the survival of the Italian army in North Africa, along with the arrival of Erwin Rommel and the small forces of the newly formed German Afrika Korps. For the next year and a half, British and Axis forces in North Africa alternated in chasing the other, until the pursuers' lines lengthened and supplies waned, giving the pursued in turn the opportunity to commit the same errors of exuberance. As long as the German-Italian infantry forces equally matched the British, as long as neither side achieved naval or air superiority, and as long as outside theaters sapped equally the strength of both sides, North Africa was stalemated. Finally, two unforeseen events would settle the issue for good: the arrival of a huge force of Americans in November 1942, and the growing German quagmire at and aftermath of Stalingrad, which drew reinforcements to Russia that might have been sent to bolster Axis forces in Libya and Egypt. To rescue the Italians, Hitler on February 12th had sent to Tripoli, Libya, Lieutenant General Erwin Rommel, an egocentric but unrelenting division commander during the fall of France. With a small force soon to grow to two divisions of the new Afrika Korps, Rommel was supposed to coordinate a joint Italian-German defense, stop the British advance in Cyrenaica, the coastal region of eastern Libya, and save what was left of Italian expeditionary forces. The long North African front, eventually in the west to extend from Tunis, Tunisia to El Alamein, Egypt, stretched roughly 1,600 miles, 400 miles farther than the overland route from Berlin to Moscow. And Rommel was to have nothing comparable to the more than 150 German divisions that would soon invade the Soviet Union. Still, he arrived in North Africa at a time when the German army had never suffered a major defeat, and still believed that its quality trumped the quantity of resources of any enemy it faced. In a famous exchange, Rommel was supposed to have told a captured British general, "What difference does it make if you have two tanks to my one when you spread them out and let me smash them in detail?" Rommel's more precise orders were to wait until May when a second division, the 15th Panzer, arrived. Then he was to tie down British troops while not diverting resources and attention from the impending Operation Barbarossa. Almost immediately upon arrival with just one German and two Italian divisions, Rommel went back on the offensive near El Algila in March 1941. He was to sweep the heretofore victorious British, who were weakened by the transfer of four divisions to Greece, entirely out of Cyrenaica. North Africa was the swashbuckling Rommel's landscape, flat, clear and ideal for panzer operations, and distant from both the controlling Hitler and the yes-men of the German general staff. Yet Rommel's supplies were inadequate, his tanks near obsolete. No matter, in just 12 days, the Germans advanced 350 miles. By splitting his smaller forces, both to follow the coast and cut across the desert, Rommel caused panic among the British, in much the same way they had just done to the Italians. Within 3 weeks, Benghazi had fallen, Tobruk was surrounded, and the British were back across the border into Egypt, even before the much-awaited April arrival of the German 15th Panzer Division. Rommel's complete turnaround of the North African War proved tactically brilliant and suggests he could have done the Wehrmacht even more good on the Eastern Front, especially given his ability to work with under-equipped and poorly trained allies. The Italians, Rommel's side, had acquired a very considerable inferiority complex, as was not surprising in the circumstances. Their infantry was practically without anti-tank weapons, and their artillery completely obsolete. Their training was also a long way short of modern standards, so that we were continually being faced by serious breakdowns. Many Italian officers had thought of war as little more than a pleasant adventure and were, perforce, having to suffer a bitter disillusionment. Rommel's reinvention of the Axis force was accomplished with just the German Light 5th Division and its Italian cohorts. His superiors among the supreme command of the German army were aghast. The original mission had been to save a wrecked Italian army. The Axis aim was not yet to open an entire new offensive on the eve of Operation Barbarossa, especially as there was no serious German strategic blueprint to follow from even the most successful of Rommel's envisioned victories. The generals at the supreme command of the armed forces in Berlin could never quite figure out how to square the circle of Rommel's successes becoming too much of a good thing, somewhat in the manner that George S. Patton's later brilliant August 1944 dash across France did not fit Chaif's Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force preconceived outline for a broad front Anglo-American advance toward the Rhine. One of Rommel's staff intelligence officers, the well-regarded Friedrich Wilhelm von Mellenthin, thought at one point Rommel might have changed the complexion of the entire war. The German high command, to which I was subordinate, still failed to see the importance of the African theater. They did not realize that with relatively small means, we could have won victories in the Near East, which, in their strategic and economic value, would have far surpassed the conquest of the Don Bend in southern Russia. Ahead of us lay territories containing an enormous wealth of raw materials. Africa, for example, and the Middle East, which would have freed us from all our anxieties about oil. A few more divisions for my army, with supplies for them guaranteed, would have sufficed to bring about the complete defeat of the entire British forces in the Near East. But it was not to be. If he were supplied, and if his superiors in Berlin had a consistent grand strategy to further German aims against Britain and a soon-to-be-enemy Russia, there was no reason why Rommel could not defeat the retreating British in Egypt as he had in Libya. But his logistics first depended on capturing the besieged port of Tobruk, the ability of the Italian navy to remain on the offensive, and Hitler's willingness to send him more than just two divisions. Unfortunately, Generals Franz Halder and Friedrich Paulus of the German General Staff found Rommel a pain, full of inordinate ambition with character defects and a brutality that made him extremely hard to get along with. The British military analyst B. H. Lydell Hart perhaps best summed up Rommel as, "Exasperating to his staff officers, he was worshipped by his fighting troops." Nonetheless, Rommel could not persuade Hitler that he had the ability to take Suez, cut off the British from Mideast oil, and turn the Mediterranean once again into an Axis lake. Or rather, he was not able to make the argument to OKH that the Wehrmacht had sufficient supplies and the ability to get them to Rommel, commensurate with the needs of such bold operations. By mid-June 1941, Rommel had beaten off all of General Wavell's series of sustained British attacks from the east designed to relieve British-held Tobruk, perhaps the first time in the war that Germany had fought a purely defensive battle. With the British exhausted, now all of Egypt to Suez was largely defenseless. Wavell's beaten forces retreated toward Al-Alamein, a rail stop just 66 miles west of Alexandria. Yet without the small port and fortress at Tobruk, no sustained German operations eastward were likely. So the war entered yet another phase of continued seesaw momentum. Only a third major British effort in November 1941 by the newly constituted 8th Army under General Claude Auchinleck finally relieved Tobruk. British failures had lured Rommel to conduct a counteroffensive that faltered for lack of supplies. Now he was forced to give up taking Tobruk and began to undertake a long retreat all the way back to El Agila, where he had started his original offensive the prior March. By New Year's 1942, Rommel's forces were smaller than when he had begun, and the British, despite their losses, had far more men, tanks, and planes than before the arrival of Rommel. Most generals would have resigned in desperation and written the entire past year off as an utter failure, as a prelude to a bitter retirement. Not Rommel. With some modest resupply and a growing Luftwaffe presence under Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, he steadily reclaimed all that he had lost. Rommel soon enjoyed almost mystical status among his Africa Corps troops, bringing to mind Virgil's famous comment on improbable achievement, "Possunt quia posse videntur." They can because they think they can. Enid 5, 231. Perhaps Rommel, the erstwhile battalion commander responsible for Hitler's personal safety, won for a time without adequate logistical support because he made his troops assume that they were not just invincible, but also professional soldiers who were more a throwback to the German Imperial Army than Hitler's Wehrmacht. 6 months later, on June 21, 1942, a returning Rommel finally took Tobruk in a single day, capturing 33,000 British and Commonwealth prisoners. The port was full of supplies. Rommel believed at last that he could resume attacks eastward toward Alexandria. With an initially successful Case Blue, the 1942 renewed offensive into the Caucasus and Army Group South on the advance to the Volga River, combined with the recent fall of both Singapore and the Philippines, the Axis, in the operational sense, seemed once again unstoppable. Unfortunately for now Field Marshal Rommel, his supply lines, never adequate, had deteriorated even more since the past summer. Germany had suffered over 1 million casualties on the Eastern Front and faced an existential struggle in its drive to the Caucasus, with a rendezvous looming at Stalingrad. The Italian Navy had lost its brief Mediterranean parity. America had entered the war and was already sending supplies to the British and soon to the Russians, with plans to invade both Algeria and Morocco. Because of transfers of men and air power to the east, the Luftwaffe was losing air supremacy in the Mediterranean. Nonetheless, Rommel sent the Axis troops for a third time into British-held Egypt. He had no assurance that his army could be supplied, and knew well the logistical failures of both prior Axis invasions of Egypt. But in the best or most blinkered traditions of the Imperial German Army of World War I, Rommel felt that his own leadership was an unquantifiable force multiplier, and that ensuing operational success might create unforeseen strategic opportunities. More darkly, the alternative would be to have static forces wither on the vine and die. By the end of June, Rommel's forces had reached El Alamein, just over 70 miles from Alexandria, and encamped in hopes of replenishing supplies from Tobruk. All the German fantasies of nearly reaching the end of the war, seeing the spires of the Kremlin, whittling down the RAF to the last reserve squadron, or climbing Mount Elbrus in the Caucasus, reappeared. Control of the Suez Canal, link-up in the oil-rich Caucasus with Army Group South, and an Axis Mediterranean. But Rommel's support base at Tobruk was still some 350 miles away. Some Axis supply ships could only be landed at Tripoli, 1,400 miles distant. Predictably, by late September, Rommel's lengthening supply train gave out. 85% of his vehicles, in the tradition of German parasitism, were worn-out, captured British models, and there were no reserves of gasoline left. At the Second Battle of El Alamein that began on October 23rd, the Africa Corps faced off against newly appointed General Bernard Montgomery and his resupplied Eighth Army. Monty enjoyed vast advantages over Rommel in every category of manpower, fuel, artillery, planes, and tanks, including a fresh shipment of 300 new American Shermans. In autumn 1942, for a brief moment, Shermans were still superior to almost all German armor in North Africa. Monty was above all prudent and not the commander to charge into Rommel's prepared defenses. Allied intelligence intercepts supplied Montgomery with accurate knowledge of Rommel's plans. The landscape of El Alamein favored the defensive preparations of the British. The German high command on the eve of the battle was a mess. A sick Rommel himself was on medical leave when the fighting began. He could not return until its third day. His replacement, General Georg Stumme, died on the second day of the battle of an apparent heart attack. Hitler intervened, forbidding strategic retreats, repeating suicidal orders given on the Eastern Front. The fighting outside Stalingrad deflected almost all the attention of OKW to Russia. In over 2 weeks of fighting, October 23rd through November 7th, Montgomery steadily wore down Rommel's defenses. The problem with the German withdrawal was that the Africa Corps had neither adequate supplies nor sufficient air cover to save the army. Without fuel supplies, Germans could not advance, yet they could not really retreat either. All that saved what was left of the Africa Corps was the decision by Rommel, who had finally returned to the battlefield on October 25th, to ignore Hitler's standfast orders. He would abandon most of Libya and scamper all the way back to near the Tunisian border, betting that the cautious Montgomery would not aggressively pursue and that the Americans would not yet land and march from the west at his rear. When Rommel finally disengaged from the running battlefield, his German and Italian forces had fewer than 10,000 combat-ready troops. The rest had been killed, wounded, captured, or were without any equipment. For all practical purposes, there was no Africa Corps left in North Africa other than Rommel's remnants and a few Italian garrison troops in Libya. Rommel had gambled that his tiny forces could be supplied by drawing on relatively idle German occupation troops and assets in France and Norway, as well as taking Malta to ensure more supply convoys. Rather than redirecting supplies from the Eastern Front, Rommel may have thought he could open and win a new theater that might help relieve the troubled German efforts in Russia. Only a bold effort to hit Alexandria and cut off Suez justified a German presence in the North African backwater at all. Rommel knew that even in summer 1941, Germany still had the supplies to fuel his advance. Later, Hitler confirmed his suspicion when he somehow sent considerable reinforcements under more trying conditions to Tunisia, much of them by air, to meet the Americans in November 1942 and early 1943. Rommel rightly believed that his supply dilemma had hinged on willpower, or perhaps on creating facts on the ground through spectacular victories that would force OKW to send help. The experience of all successful invading European captains in North Africa, whether Scipio Africanus' invasion of Carthage in 203 BC, Gaius's defeat of the Numidian king Jugurtha 107-105 BC, or the Byzantine Belisarius's destruction of the Vandal Empire in AD 528, hinged on relatively small armies advancing with secure supply routes, usually ensured by sea from Europe. Rommel's unsuccessful experience proved no different. But whereas ancient armies knew what their objectives were in North Africa, Hitler's did not, other than not losing too quickly to superior Allied forces. After Pearl Harbor and the decision to concentrate on Europe first, General George Marshall, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, understandably argued for an invasion of the French coast as soon as possible. In part, the Army staff was also guided by the American experience of World War I. The United States then had declared war on April 6, 1917, likewise with an army of less than 200,000. Yet from June 26, 1917 to November 11, 1918, the United States had deployed over 2 million soldiers in France, finally arriving at the rate of 10,000 a day. The huge buildup led to the general collapse of the Imperial German Army. Even though all of continental Europe was now de facto under German control, and landing in 1942 would be quite different from 1917, France no longer existed as an Allied state, the Americans still believed that at least an early 1943 invasion could replay World War I. After all, in 1918 they had beaten the predecessor of the German army that they were about to meet in battle. Some in the Army Air Force were still convinced that daylight unescorted bombing might render the Third Reich ill-prepared for the defense of Europe. When the U.S. Army was finally persuaded by the British that the Western Allies had neither the numbers nor the requisite landing craft, armor and artillery and air support to land in Western Europe in 1943, much less 1942, the compromise solution on the specific order of President Franklin Roosevelt, who overrode his military advisers, sent the Americans into the fight on the periphery in North Africa. A landing somewhere in western North Africa would show the American people that their ground troops were at last in the fight against Germany and Italy, and help to ensure safe shipping through the Mediterranean from Gibraltar through Suez. Several scheduled Anglo-American landings in Morocco and Algeria, Operation Torch, were designed to capture the key ports at Casablanca, Oran, and Algiers. Over 100,000 British and American troops, embarking from both the United States and Britain, would pressure Vichy French forces to join them. This display of vast Anglo-American power would help to convince Spain that it had been and should continue to be wise to remain neutral. The British and Americans would soon block the German and Italian forces in Tunisia from the west, while squeezing the Germans between the advancing and vastly reinforced Eighth Army under Montgomery. The American Army saw all this as a warm-up for a cross-channel landing the next year, an opportunity to evaluate doctrine, equipment, and command personnel. But the British did not. They instead envisioned the conquest of North Africa as a stepping stone to knocking fascist Italy out of the war and advancing through the so-called soft underbelly of Europe into Austria. That thrust might preclude entirely a costly cross-channel invasion of France and not put Britain in the position of functioning as a launching pad for an amphibious attack on the French Atlantic coast that would probably fail. The fighting took 6 months because a belated but substantial German airlift to Tunis had brought in tons of supplies, tanks, artillery, and initially over a division of fresh soldiers. The sudden attention that Hitler paid to North Africa was an odd development, since during far better times a year earlier he had assured Rommel that there were no such forces to be spared for his Egyptian sideshow. But by the end of November 1942, the reconstituted German-Italian Panzer Army had altogether three new divisions to add to the existing Italian army in Libya and what was left of the original Africa Corps. Rommel took command of what by early 1943 would be known as an enlarged Army Group Africa and obtained some successes against the inexperienced Americans and their incompetent senior officers, especially in a series of battles culminating in their first major encounter at the Kasserine Pass, February 19th through the 24th, 1943, before turning the supreme command over to General Hans-Jürgen von Arnim in March 1943. But the Western Allies were pouring in men and supplies at a rate well beyond the Axis's ability to match. And the Americans, after suffering nearly 6,500 casualties and nearly 200 tanks destroyed at Kasserine to the withering fire of German anti-tank guns, were retraining and determined never again to be humiliated in battle. Rommel flew home in March, hoping either to obtain more reinforcements or a decision to evacuate. He achieved neither and never returned to North Africa. The Axis surrendered nearly 250,000 men on May 13, 1943, a loss comparable to the destruction of the Sixth Army at Stalingrad, although Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels sighed that at least most of the Third Reich soldiers were captured by Western forces rather than sent to their certain deaths in Soviet camps, as was true after Stalingrad. For the duration of Rommel's life, he would receive forwarded letters of encouragement from his old veterans of the Africa Corps, but from their imprisonment in the American South. In a famous anecdote reported in a contemporary issue of Time magazine, Italian prisoners on their way to prison camps in America replied to the jeers of one of their American captors, "All right, laugh, but we're going to America. You're going to Italy." Tens of thousands of Germany's best veteran troops, along with their Italian allies, had needlessly been left to fend for themselves. Colonel Hans von Luck was sent by the Africa Corps to Berlin, presumably as an authentic voice of the plight of the surrounded Axis armies, to beg Hitler to allow a withdrawal to Sicily. "Listen, Luck," General Alfred Jodl, head of OKW, told Luck when he arrived in Berlin, "there is absolutely no question of evacuating elements of the African army, or of considering a German Dunkirk, as you call it. The Führer is not ready to think of retreat. We won't even let you see him personally. He would have a fit of rage and throw you out." Luck was then led to a campaign map of the Eastern Front, where Jodl pointed out to him the similar but perhaps even greater recent catastrophe at Stalingrad. Between the twin disasters of Stalingrad and North Africa, the German army lost over 500,000 of their best soldiers and never recovered. The Mediterranean had suddenly become an Allied lake. Sicily was now endangered, and German-held Crete was soon to become largely irrelevant. Millions of tons of Allied shipping could, without opposition, reach Britain from the Indian Ocean through the shorter route via the Suez Canal, with far less worry of German aircraft and U-boats. Vichy North Africa and the fence-sitting dictatorships of the Iberian Peninsula made the necessary political adjustments. The Western Allies' tactical air forces grew enormously. But at this juncture in the war, new German Tiger tanks were still rare. Panthers, non-existent, and early model Mark III's and IVs, no better than the far more numerous new Shermans. Given their respective performances in North Africa, Generals Patton and Montgomery seemed comparable to the best of German generals, and the British and American armies still concentrated on a single front. The Anglo-Americans had gained valuable experience with amphibious operations and trained the armies that were eventually to reach Germany. German strength had been weakened by the Mediterranean War. Allied power had been increased. The victorious British and Americans next chose to invade not France, but Italy. By starting in Sicily, they were following in the footsteps of history's prior African-based armies, such as Belisarius's small Byzantine force in AD 535, given that the closest distance from Cape Boeo, Sicily, to Cape Bon, Tunisia, across the Mediterranean, is only about 75 miles, a shorter distance of travel than from the western Sicilian city of Marsala to the Straits of Messina. The Roman historian Livy records the dramatic story of how the elder Cato warned the Roman Senate of the dangers of an aggressive Carthage by dropping a fig from a fold in his toga while admonishing the senators that it was still fresh, given that it had been picked just 3 days earlier, the aggregate direct travel time between Carthage and Rome. The British thought that while taking Sicily was ideal for invading southern Italy, history suggested that it hardly would be conducive as a starting point for an invasion into Austria. A better idea, they argued, might have been to attack Italy farther northward from the island of Sardinia or even Corsica. Occupation of either island would have far more easily facilitated a subsequent amphibious landing in northern Italy, cutting off German forces higher up on the peninsula. The Americans, however, saw Sicily not so much as a pathway into Central Europe as a way to ensure an open Mediterranean to shipping and to use air bases in Sicily as an alternate method of bombing the southern and eastern regions of the Third Reich. More important, Sicily was the first amphibious operation in the European theater of an unequivocally hostile coast. The campaign was felt by the Americans, in particular, to be a needed warm-up for the anticipated invasion of France in spring 1944. Three American divisions left from Tunisia, a fourth from Oran, Algeria. They all linked up as the Western Task Force under Major General George Patton's 7th Army that landed on the southern corner of the island. Bernard Montgomery's British Imperial Force steamed from Suez, landing near Patton. The British and Americans envisioned launching attacks from a 100-mile strip of beaches northward to Messina to prevent some quarter of a million Axis troops from escaping to Italy. Operation Husky, July 9th through August 17th, 1943, however, was conceptually flawed from the beginning, or simply too sophisticated given the level of Allied experience and training. Montgomery and Patton were rivals rather than partners. Airdrops, the first of a checkered pattern to follow, were plagued by high winds that scattered paratroopers well beyond their targets. The Western Allies did not send amphibious forces to Messina to block an early Axis escape to the Italian mainland. Omar Bradley and British generals deprecated George Patton's use of small amphibious operations to outflank German resistance, when they should have encouraged more of them and on a greater scale. After 5 weeks of hard fighting, the British and Americans linked up in Messina, but not before more than half the defending force, consisting of over 100,000 Italians and Germans, had crossed the straits safely into Italy. General Montgomery, as well as Omar Bradley, had shown a peculiar habit of winning campaigns while letting a defeated enemy flee to regroup. After El Alamein, here in Sicily, and soon at the Falaise Pocket in Normandy. Any time Hitler did not insist on a trapped army standing fast to the last man dead or captured, German armies had an uncanny ability to escape sure encirclements. Strategically, the invasion of Sicily at least had prompted the arrest of Mussolini on July 23rd and the collapse of his fascist government. That exit forced Hitler to assume control over the Axis defenses, ensuring a civil war inside Italy, a scenario that the two allies in some ways would have perhaps liked to avoid. Yet the Americans and British had Sicily as an airbase to ensure bombing attacks on the Italian mainland. Both British and American units fought well against the more seasoned Germans, losing about as many casualties as they inflicted. Sicily bridged the British desire for a Mediterranean strategy and an American warm-up for a cross-channel invasion. Sicily, for a brief time, placated the nagging Stalin that his allies were determined to eventually open a major second front on the ground. yet the Americans and British still had not reached the European mainland. To do so would require a new series of amphibious landings along the southern and central Italian coast, to be followed by a plodding march upward through various fortified German defensive lines, rivers, and mountain ranges that would not end until the end of World War II itself. Italy had not been formally decided upon as the next Allied step before the invasion of Sicily, but it was apparently the logical follow-up, given the near proximity of large Allied forces and their growing confidence of routing the Axis. Although it was close and an otherwise plausible target, the Italian mainland presented another degree of difficulty. Even Naples, in whose environs the American Fifth Army under General Mark Clark landed at Salerno on September 9th, was over 500 miles from Vienna, Austria, more than the distance from the Normandy coast to the Rhine. Nor was it certain that the collapse of Mussolini's government and the new government's official alliance in September with the Western Allies meant all that much. The sudden surrender of hundreds of thousands of Italian troops and millions of dependents required that vast amounts of food and fuel be diverted. Liberated from Mussolini's fascism only to be subjected to Hitler's, Italy now experienced the war on its own ground with frightening new intensity. The Wehrmacht had little reason to respect the property and lives of its former hosts. Italian fascist diehards battled communist partisans, and as most Italians were neither, they got caught between outbreaks of civil strife and also between American, British, French, and German armor, artillery, and bombs. In early August 1943, the mercurial and exhausted General Patton grew increasingly irate when told of a rising number of combat stress cases in his 7th Army that required evacuation to hospitals. As a result, Patton slapped two U.S. soldiers on separate visits to evacuation hospitals. Both men were suffering from more than battle fatigue, one from malaria, the other from dehydration and fever. The resulting media and public outcry over what appeared to be bullying ill-combat soldiers, in a fashion antithetical to American values, forced General Eisenhower to insist on Patton's subsequent removal from a combat command for 11 months. Although Patton had not been scheduled to lead forces in Italy, he nonetheless sat idle in Sicily while the stalled American army was poorly led not far away in Italy and in great need of his service. The failure to utilize Patton's expertise and savvy both in Italy and in the initial planning and landings of Operation Overlord probably cost Allied lives and raised difficult questions of military morality. Patton's misguided efforts to increase battlefield participation were at odds with the egalitarian and democratic nature of the American Army. Yet, sidelining the best combat general in the U.S. Army at a time when competent commanders were in short supply caused deaths both in Italy and perhaps during the initial American immobility in Normandy. The bitter Allied experience in Italy would be plagued by almost continual command mistakes and catastrophes until the end of the war in 1945. General Matthew Ridgway wisely canceled ill-considered initial airborne drops on Rome at the last minute. General Mark Clark's caution almost ruined the Allied amphibious effort at Salerno. The Allies had vastly underestimated the effect of winter and spring weather in going northward, as well as the rough terrain of the Apennine Mountains. The Nazi zealot and Hitler favorite Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, later charged and convicted of war crimes, was underrated by General Clark and would prove as skilled as the more famous generals Walter Model and Gotthard Heinrici when fighting on the defensive. In strict military terms, the fanatic Kesselring was the German version of the equally gifted but similarly underappreciated General William Slim, the British savior of Burma, perhaps because Slim likewise often fought in theaters that were less known and publicized. The Allies had little conception of the difficulty of breaching the network of winter obstacles incorporating the Gustav, Bernhardt, and Hitler lines, and were stymied both by entrenched Germans and rough weather for the remainder of 1943. They lost an initial opportunity for a breakout from the amphibious landing at Anzio, January 22, 1944, due to the sluggishness of Major General John P. Lucas, who allowed the initially stunned Germans to regroup when they might have been entrapped by the more vigorous leadership of a Patton. The entire series of German defensive lines presaged the brilliant preparations that General Ridgway would later use in early 1951 to bleed advancing Chinese Red Army troops into South Korea, or perhaps was analogous in spirit to Robert E. Lee's inspired defense of Richmond that nearly destroyed the cohesion of the attacking Army of the Potomac for much of the late spring and summer of 1864. General Clark, as Field Marshal Kesselring had anticipated, ordered his forces, when they finally broke out from Anzio in May, to head to Rome to claim the ancient glories of the triumph. They entered Rome on June 4th, 2 days before D-Day. The capture may have been symbolically rewarding, but in practical terms it probably allowed the German 10th Army to escape encirclement, nullifying some of the original purpose of the Anzio landing. The earlier, supposedly diversionary frontal assault across the Rapido River, January 20th to the 22nd, 1944, had proved a veritable pathway into German minefields and artillery barrages, and reflected the vintage World War I ineptness of the Allies, more of whom would die after Anzio than prior to the landing, often in courageous though poorly thought-out assaults on prepared German positions. The area bombing of the monastery at Monte Cassino, February 15, 1944, proved a military and cultural nightmare. The failure to bridge the Germans' carefully prepared Gothic line spanning northern Italy in fall 1944 derailed Churchill's dream of a huge pincer heading up through Slovenia into Austria through the Ljubljana Gap, relieving pressure on the Allied armies in France and occupying at least some of Eastern Europe before the arrival of the Soviet Red Army. The survival of Mussolini's northern Italian fascist puppet government, Repubblica Sociale Italiana, led to more civil war among warring Italian factions. The withdrawal of thousands of American troops to western and southern France as part of Operation Dragoon's expeditionary force of 500,000 soldiers, and of the British to Greece, reminded the Western Allies that they had far too few ground troops in Europe, and likely contributed to the Allied inability to reach Austria before the end of the war. The 608-day effort to invade, occupy, and traverse Italy, as opposed to shifting attention elsewhere after Sicily, remains the most controversial Allied theater of the war. In terms of relative casualties, 312,000 Allied versus 435,000 German, and results achieved, it is hard to justify the costs. The theater drew off resources from the planned Allied invasion of France as much as it weakened German defenses in Western Europe. The conquest of Sicily had already resulted in conditions that would doom Mussolini and sow political chaos among the Axis, but without having to enter the mainland quagmire of domestic factionalism and German retribution. New Allied air bases on the island more or less ensured air superiority over most of the Mediterranean, although bomber bases in southern Italy proved additionally useful in attacking eastern Germany. Most German forces in Italy would still have been kept in a defensive crunch in Italy, away from the Normandy invasion, without the messy fact of a major invasion. The Italian theater had other drawbacks. British and American disagreements about a Mediterranean grand strategy for defeating Germany weakened their cooperation. To achieve a quick victory in 1943 and 1944 would have required an aggressive Allied Supreme Theater commander other than Mark Clark. The impending D-Day landings shorted supplies and manpower. The irony was manifold. Churchill grew depressed that his pet project was a costly failure, while Roosevelt, whose generals opposed the Italian invasion, remained upbeat that the attrition of German forces was worth the effort. Although the Americans had been right all along that the quickest way to end the war was instead to land in France and head eastward, the British had correctly warned that the Allies were not up to the task until mid-1944. In between those two irreconcilable positions lay the open wound in Italy. The crotchety and often hyperbolic J.F.C. Fuller, an insightful student of military history, may well have been mostly right to have concluded of the Italian effort that it was a senseless campaign of destruction, one with inadequate means, with no strategic goal, and with no political bottom. By spring 1944, most Allied bomber strategists privately accepted that they were never going to end the war with air power, or at least negate the need for a second infantry Western Front in France. The only way both to fulfill the promise to the Soviets of fighting on the European continent and to reach Germany and play a decisive role in the surrender and occupation was to land, as envisioned at the beginning of the American entry into the war, on the western coast of France and to march eastward and cross the Rhine. The D-Day invasion of Normandy, Operation Overlord, was the largest combined land and sea operation conducted since the invasion of Greece by King Xerxes of Persia in spring 480 BC. It dwarfed all of history's star-crossed beach landings from Marathon to Gallipoli, April 1915. Normandy would serve as a model for large subsequent American seaborne operations from Iwo Jima, February 1945, and Okinawa, April 1945, to Incheon, September 1950. It made all prior iconic cross-channel invasions in either direction, Caesar's 55 BC, William the Conqueror's 1066, Henry V's 1415, or the 1809 British landing in Flanders, seem minor amphibious operations in comparison. What made Operation Overlord feasible, aside from Allied air, naval, and material superiority and accumulated amphibious experience in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy, was that unlike many of their earlier seaborne operations in the Mediterranean, the Allies were based nearby in Great Britain. Even the most distant French beaches at Normandy were only about 140 miles away from Portsmouth and the British supply, embarkation points, and airfields. For weeks on end and all through the landings and breakout, the American and British air fleet easily pounded Normandy and, as a decoy, most of the northern French ports. And the result was that aside from shredding German communications and rail links, French citizens died in droves. Between the bombing, strafing, and artillery strikes once the Allies landed, and the five-month preparatory bombardment before D-Day, at least 35,000 French residents were killed, roughly equal to all the fatalities of American and British ground forces in the Normandy campaign, June 6 through August 25th. When added to civilian fatalities in bombing operations other than those connected with D-Day, the total number of French civilians killed by Allied firepower may have exceeded 70,000, a figure far greater than all British civilians killed in the Blitz and during the V1 and V2 attacks, and all French civilians killed by Germans after the 1940 occupation, and nearly equal to the number of French Jews rounded up and sent eastward to the extermination camps. Over 150,000 Allied troops landed the first day on five British, Canadian, and American-assigned beaches, along with over 25,000 airborne soldiers dropped behind German lines. Unlike possible spots in the Cotentin Peninsula or at Calais, the Allies believed that landings in Normandy would pose far more of a surprise, given the somewhat greater distance from Britain. More important, the expansive geography of the Normandy beaches would not box in the invading Allied armies on a confined peninsula or allow the Germans to focus on a narrow front. Unlike the prior landings in Sicily and Italy, Operation Overlord had been carefully planned for over a year, drawing on the lessons from the Allies' past amphibious problems at Dieppe, Sicily, Salerno, and Anzio. New inventions and weapons were crafted for the invasion, from portable Mulberry harbors to Pluto, pipelines under the ocean, fuel lines laid under the English Channel, and to Sherman and Churchill tanks modified to uncover mines, cut barbed wire, provide pathways over soft beaches, and bridge obstacles. Never had a larger, more powerful fleet, Operation Neptune, been assembled in the English Channel to transport, supply, and protect the invasion force. The British and Canadian navies provided over 80% of the armada of well over 1,000 warships, accompanied by almost 6,000 supply vessels and landing craft. The sailors, nearly 200,000, were more numerous than the troops who landed the first day. the days of the Bismarck and the Prinz Eugen on the high Atlantic seas, or of U-boats leaving their channel concrete pens in wolf packs, were long gone. Although the Germans were now equipping their Western forces with superb second-generation weapons, from Tiger and Panther tanks to Panzerfäuste, single-shot disposable anti-tank weapons, and Panzerschrecks, improved German versions of the American bazooka, and to the STG-42 assault rifle, Allied tactical air supremacy, especially Typhoon and Thunderbolt fighter bombers, proved far more the force multiplier. The successful landings did not go as smoothly as planned, partly due to the rough seas and high winds that blew landing craft off course or submerged them. Partly the confusion was due to the sheer complexity of the operation and to the nature of the beaches, which were far less known than those at Calais. Partly, planners had underestimated the disadvantageous landscapes behind the beaches, especially in the case of Omaha. But perhaps most important, the Allied generals had misjudged the depth of German defenses at the American beaches and had failed to insist on a much longer and heavier naval bombardment, a lapse that probably cost hundreds of American lives. In fact, only two beaches of the five were linked up the first day. Few nearby towns such as Bayeux, Carentan, and Saint-Lô were immediately captured as envisioned. The major city of Cayambe would not be taken for 6 weeks. The Allies suffered 10,000 casualties on the beaches, including over 4,000 dead. The Germans, in the manner of the French over half a millennium earlier before the Battle of Agincourt, 1415, who were unsure whether Henry V's English army would land at Normandy or Calais, were still more confused than the attackers and affected by their elaborate efforts at deception. The defenders were somewhat confident that the main enemy focus would either come far to the north at Pas-de-Calais or perhaps not be staged amid storms. The Allies quickly achieved a foothold that was secure enough over the next week to serve the huge push of men and material that followed pathways in part secured by airborne troops. Allied air power and naval gunfire helped to ward off some counterattacks on the beachheads. The Germans had never quite decided whether to adopt General Rommel's wiser advice to commit the panzer reserves immediately against the beachheads, before the Allied logistical advantages became overwhelming, or in the traditionalist view of General von Rundstedt and most others at OKH, especially General Guderian, to keep the armor back as a central reserve to cut off the invaders once they broke out. In the end, the Germans did both and succeeded at neither. The counter-assaults of the reserve panzer units against the beaches were too fragmented and small, and under constant air attack. Within a week, there was a nearly 100-mile contiguous beachhead. Within a month, 1 million Allied troops had landed, and the vision of the original planners of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force entering Germany was now becoming clearer. It no longer mattered whether Hitler's panzer reserves were immediately deployed at the beachheads or sent in from the rear. Allied air superiority attacked them anywhere they moved, even down to the individual motorcyclist and foot soldier. The widespread appearance of both the American P-47 Thunderbolt, heavy, fast, with considerable firepower and a durable air-cooled engine, and the British Hawker Typhoon, when used as ground support fighter bombers, was worth the equivalent of hundreds of tanks. The Allied efforts to reach Germany now had two main continental fronts, east and west, in addition to the stalled effort in Italy, and all their comparative rates of progress would become roughly interconnected and at times abrasively politicized. The Russians had complained since autumn 1941 that they were bearing most of the weight of the Wehrmacht. Stalin shamelessly ignored his own prior partnership with Hitler and hopes for a Nazi victory over Great Britain, as well as the huge shipments of British and American supplies to the Red Army. He kept silent about the previous North African, Sicilian, or Italian campaigns as valuable second fronts, given that the Germans had not substantially reduced their Eastern Front forces much below 3 million soldiers. Nor even by June 1944 had strategic bombing drawn off enough artillery and fighters from the Wehrmacht, at least in the eyes of the Red Army. At this time, Stalin also had no interest or little ability in helping the Anglo-Americans against the Japanese in Asia and the Pacific by opening a second front, and most certainly did not wish to end his agreements with the Japanese that were allowing American lend-lease merchant ships free entry into Vladivostok. After the victory at Stalingrad, February 1943, Stalin had believed that the Wehrmacht was on the verge of collapse, prompting a series of unwise Soviet offensives that achieved almost nothing, especially given that Hitler had transferred 20 divisions from the West on the hunch that there would be no second front in 1943. Yet Stalin had regained his confidence after the key Battle of Kursk, July 4th through August 23rd, 1943, and once again was becoming somewhat less insistent on an Allied cross-channel invasion, a fact that might suggest that privately he understood the valuable role of both Allied bombing and fighting in the Mediterranean in drawing off German resources from the Eastern Front, or felt that the resurgent Red Army alone could overrun all of Germany and even liberate Western Europe to the post-war advantage of the Soviet Union. Nonetheless, as the Russians neared the Polish border and set to commemorate the three-year anniversary of the German invasion, the Red Army was preparing a knockout blow against the German Army Group Center, Operation Bagration, June 22nd through August 19th, 1944, which would divert German attention to the east while the Allies were pinned in the hedgerows beyond the Normandy beaches. Bagration would prove the largest and most successful Soviet operation of the war. Over 2 million troops from the Soviet Baltic and Belarusian armies, the most mobile of Soviet forces with over 200,000 mostly U.S.-supplied trucks, in less than a month all but destroyed Army Group Center. That hole in the German front now offered a clear trajectory to Warsaw, and by July the Red Army was about the same distance from Berlin as were the newly landed Allies in Normandy. The veteran Russians were closer to the heartland of traditional German militarism in East Prussia, but the Allies in the West were also only about 500 miles from the industrial Ruhr and the center of the German military-industrial complex. The paradox arose that the Allies could reach central Germany at about the same time as the Russians,